Tambi, welcome to Money Bites. Super excited to have you here.
I'm excited to be here.
We have quite a lot to talk about. As you know, Winnie is a community of women in tech and allies where we're talking openly about our career and money journey. Our resident first three questions. The first two are, give us a one-liner about yourself. The second is, what is a surprising trivia about yourself? I'll ask the third after you answer the first two.
Okay, that sounds good. So let me give a one-liner about myself. So Miki, you know me now by now, but hi, I'm Tanvi. I'm a senior data scientist at Amazon, and I have basically moved careers from architecture, which was about 10 years ago, to data science right now. I live in New Jersey, and right now, really enjoying the summer.
Fellow Garden City.
Yes.
Love it. Surprising trivia about yourself.
Yes, that's interesting. I haven't been asked that for a while, but I think the surprising trivia would be that I am a huge chocolate lover. I need to have chocolate every day. And I know people say it's not a need, it's a want, but it's more a need for me. But I'm actually allergic to chocolate. So it's been pretty interesting navigating that.
Do you still navigate it if you're allergic to it?
Wait. It's not like deadly allergic. It's like I break out into like a couple of hives and it calms down after a while. It's not too bad. So it's still manageable, which is why I still need chocolate.
Gotcha. Okay. Is it solid form? Is it liquid form? Any type of chocolate?
No, it's definitely solid form. So dark chocolate, specifically with nuts.
Not good taste. Okay.
Yeah, I see
the dilemma. Third question. What is your first memory of money?
I guess in my childhood, I come from, a broken family. And my dad was very, very particular about where he spent money. So he didn't like to spend money on anything. So I've always grown up thinking that, you know, money is not that thing that buys you luxury. It's more like a need and you try not to spend it. So I don't know if that did good or bad. I think it's kind of in the middle of both, but that was my first, I guess, unfortunate memory of money where you try not to spend even if you have any.
Did your mother have a different spending pattern?
Yeah, my mom thought money was irrelevant. She's like, yeah, money is just money. It'll come, it'll go. But as long as we're happy now, that's what matters. So she loved to see that happiness rather than, you know, count the number of pennies in her pocket. And I found that a completely different perspective. So it's really nice. And I think I would be somewhere in the middle of that.
Interesting, though, that your father's perspective has had a stronger impression on you.
I guess that's because he did have a stronger influence over, you know, or at least my childhood at that point. Mm-hmm. But after that, once I started coming into my own and being my own person, yeah, I've managed to have my own perspective about money.
Did you ever find out where his POV came from?
That's a good question. Not really. No, he wasn't very open about it. So I don't know. I don't know if it comes from his, like maybe his family, something in his childhood or background. But yeah, I haven't really had the chance to ask him.
Has it played out your memory of money in any way as you grew up in your adult relationship with money?
Yes, it has. So I've definitely always been careful with money. So, and I actually believe that every penny does count. But I think there has to be a good balance. There has to be a balance when you save that money and keep it for maybe a rainy day or, you know, if you just like to see that number grow in your bank account, I'm not sure. But you also need to spend it on yourself, on your family, see that. Like, I love getting gifts for my friends and family and seeing that happiness on the face, and money allows you to do that. So I would say I still save every penny. And if, for example, I never drink coffee and it's not a need and you have no idea how much money people spend buying coffee outside. So if you don't buy coffee outside and drink it at home, you can just imagine if you save those $3 or $4 every single day for the next 5 years, you're still going to have a lot more than you would think at that point of time.
I see how you're the best of both worlds for your dad. I also sense some of that coffee is being swapped with chocolate. This is allergies, but
that is true.
Let's start there. I found one of the very, very interesting money stories that you shared during our pre-call on how you handled your student loans while you were doing your master's. Let's start with how you got to that point. So you started in a completely different career, architecture, as you mentioned.
I started in architecture. I did all the 5 years, and I interned through the 5 years. It's a really great career, but I did work in a lot of firms while I was doing it. And that gave me exposure to how my life would look like as an architect. So I would say it had, for me personally, it had some parts were like good. Some parts were areas that I didn't really see in my future self. So the good parts were, you know, it was really creative. You had to think outside the box and think of a different solution that you couldn't really Google and find, right? So that it made you really think hard, and it was very creative. Now, the bad parts were, it was definitely a lot of work for a little pay. That was one of it. It was also very, very small companies, and there wasn't really a growth strategy. Like, I couldn't know where I'd be in 2 years, 4 years, 5 years. I could just be in the same place that I started out at. And the third part was I didn't have the best experience with, I wouldn't say all, but I'd worked in 5 different companies, and out of them, 2 were not the best experience with my, I would say, the men managers at work. So there were no strict HR policies or anything. And it wasn't just me. It was like all the women architects were just not treated in my eyes, what I thought fairly. So that was another, I guess, third point, which is why I decided to move away from architecture and find something that challenged me a little more. Because when I was little, I loved math. Like, everything about math got me excited. I went in to do calculus, and that got me excited too. So I decided that, you know, I should find something that was more, I guess that was going to trigger both sides of my brain. So it's not just the creative side, it's also the logical and the mathematical side. And I think that's what I finally found, and actually so happy that I was able to find it.
I just want to dig into this a bit more. So you were unsatisfied at your position as an architect.
Mm-hmm.
And you were thinking about, okay, how do I fix this situation? And was it just your memory of your childhood enjoying math that you decide to pivot to data, or were there?
I guess that goes back a little bit. So I did do a lot of internships. And then what I did after that was I joined through a campus recruitment after I finished my course. I joined Tesco, and I joined there as a planner, which is kind of in between like the business and how would you, you know, decide what's the best retail layout for your store to bring in the maximum revenue. So that's kind of what my role was. But the year that I joined, I would say 6 months into it, there was a really large downsizing. And I was kind of kept to lead the analytics team because I was the only team that was left, and maybe 2 people from my team. So because I was leading, you know, a completely new domain, I understood the business aspect of things, but I wanted to understand the math side of it, the science side of it, because that's what all the analysts were doing. So I started taking a bunch of different courses, and that's kind of where it hit me. I'm like, oh my God, I've always loved math. And this is such an interesting field. It ties both the business side as well as the, you know, the logical and the mathematical side of things. So maybe I should pursue that further.
I really like how you were going about this, because I've been thinking a lot about the quote unquote perfect job, whether it exists, how much fulfillment should I be getting out of this job, etc. And one thing that I am exploring is, as I try to look for different opportunities, what are within my current scope opportunities that I can dig deeper into that brings me a bit more joy, that would get me closer in the direction of where I want to get. You found a serendipitous opportunity, unfortunately, through downsizing, but through that, you were able to dig into and find a new passion
That is true. And what you're mentioning about finding that perfect job, to be honest, I don't think a perfect job exists because we're all so different as individuals and our interests are so varied. I think it really depends on what you want to make that job. So I could, let's say, if I had a different thought of mind, a school of mind, and if I had a different perspective, maybe data science wouldn't be as important as it is to me today, and it could be just a job. But for me, it's definitely more than a job. It's that thing that, you know, keeps me challenged. It's where I keep learning, and I think that was the, like, that has been the biggest motivational factor for me, because if I can learn every single day something new, like even if it's a small thing that's new, I'm really excited, and that's what keeps me going. So it could have been in something else, right? If I didn't find data science, maybe I found another thing where I was learning every day. I could have been excited there too. But I guess that's what I'm saying. I don't think there's a perfect job, but it really depends on how our mindset is and what we're trying to find, that we can make whatever job we're in perfect, as long as it's trying to satisfy the smaller things in us, like the fact that you like to learn, the fact that you like to be challenged. So that's my perspective on it.
That's totally fair. I agree with you. Maybe a more satisfactory job than the perfect job is a better name for it.
Yeah, that's true.
One question here is, during your time at Architecture, and you kind of alluded to this, but your net worth graph is fairly stable. And one thing that we continue to talk about in tech is continuously negotiating and making sure that your total comp is something that you consider to increase as you make your move. Just curious, in Architecture, was that not feasible as you were moving across different firms, or was it less of a priority?
I think it's a mix of both, and that's a really good question. So to be honest, at that point, I don't think I knew how to negotiate. Like, what was I expecting? Can I even negotiate? Like, do I have the option of doing it, or should I just take whatever I get because I was just starting out? But what I realized is, and I could be wrong because it was 10 years ago, but what I realized through my experience in architecture firms was that there is, unless you're in the really big ones, it's really hard to estimate what your total comp should be. And because you don't have that data point, it makes it really hard to leverage that in a negotiation. So you just take whatever you get. And then when you move to another company, you're not sure, you know, if it's the same position, you're like, I don't think I have the right to negotiate for more. So it's so unclear. I think that's why I would say it definitely stayed pretty stagnant. There was no real growth for about a year or two there.
I think all the more reason why at Winnie we constantly talk about trying to break down the taboo-ness of talking about money and salaries.
Yeah,
it's so weird to do it with your coworkers, but the more information we know, the more power each of us have.
Exactly. So,
interesting. Okay. So you went through this, you found a good fit and passion for data. And then you start thinking, okay, maybe this is something I should pursue. This is something maybe I should study more up on, and getting a master's comes into the picture.
Correct. Yes. So I've always wanted to study if I could have it my way since I was a child, I would study all the time. I know that sounds really nerdy and boring, but but I loved studying. I felt challenged. I liked that I could do it in my own time. I was grasping information whenever I could. It wasn't forceful. Exams, not so much. Studying was fun. So I knew that I wanted to do my master's in something. I guess I always knew I was going to do it at some point in something, but I just didn't know what. And this I found was a perfect moment because I was like, I don't know. Like, I couldn't just jump into an industry because I don't have too many of the foundations, I guess. Or I would say I was lucky because I did computer science through from like the fifth up through the 12th grade. So I was in touch with that side. In India, it's kind of like that, where you have to no, math, you have to do math, you have to do computers. So I would say this worked in my case, thankfully. But that's when I decided that I wanted to build my foundation, because I wanted to jump into an industry which was completely new. I hadn't been in touch with it for a while because architecture is just so different. Now, when I say architecture, my favorite subject there was basically a lot with civil, so by civil engineering. So it was a lot of formulas for load-bearing beams and columns and what was the expansion, what was the area. So those were the things that excited me the most in architecture. So I thought that this was natural that I would, you know, kind of towards this path where I was going to use math that much more. So master's was always, I guess, part of my life. And if I could, I would also do a PhD, but I'm still trying to figure out if there's one particular subject that I love that I want to spend the next 3 or 4 years of my life studying.
Looking back after you've made the career switch, mm-hmm. do you think a master was needed to make that transition?
Very good question. And I would say no. So things have changed over the years. Now, a master's was good for me. Yes, I was able to get a lot of foundation. But what I learned the most was on the job. And what I learned the most was through a lot of courses that I took. And I'd be honest, I probably took through Coursera, Udemy, Google, all the different courses available outside, even LinkedIn Learning. I probably have taken over 50 or 60 in the past few years. Yeah. So I feel like that is what helped me the most in my day-to-day. But my master's in my day-to-day, not so much, but it did give me a foundation. So I don't want to discount that.
That's actually really interesting. I also love the fact that even after a degree, you're continuously investing and learning on your own, which is super interesting. The other interesting part about your master's was you had to get a student loan.
Yes.
It was quite a sum.
Yes.
But even getting the student loan was quite a journey.
It was. You're right. So, I definitely don't come from a very well-to-do family. And especially after my dad left, it was mom who had to support us for everything. And she was, you know, trying to, struggling to make ends meet. So obviously a student loan was the only way. But what I'm so grateful for is, I don't know what she saw in me at that point where I was still trying to make my decision, but she trusted that whatever decision I made, she would support it. And to be able to take the student loan, I actually, we had to put our house down as a collateral, and that's kind of all, you know, she had. And she was so worried. What if we don't pay it back? So that kind of pushed me a little more to try and figure out how do I reduce that loan that I get so that it's not such a burden. So about 80% of my, about 90% of my tuitions and was kind of paid for through scholarships because I applied for a bunch of them. And I would say I was lucky enough to get a few. And one specifically where they supported me through my entire master's. So that was very helpful. And it obviously meant that I was, you know, taking in lesser than what I would if I didn't have a scholarship. So I would say that was the hard part that was in two ways. So my mom was able to support me, but she had the faith that I would pay it back somehow at some point of time. And the fact that the scholarships really helped to, you know, reduce that burden on me as well as my mom. So I knew that it's not going to be 30 years that I pay off this loan. It's going to be much quicker that I do pay this loan off. And I was able to pay it off in about a year and a half, that is through my master's itself. So by the time I was done with my master's, I was able to pay that off.
Which I find super interesting. You've made some really good points. One, even if you get a student loan, making sure that you diversify through scholarships and other resources so that you take in as little student loan as possible.
Right.
The second part I do want to go into, you clearing out your student loan before you finished your degree. But in our pre-call, you also mentioned something that stuck with me of asking for help.
That's true. So so these are, I guess, two very important points for me as well. It was a learning for me. So what I realized was I was in a very hard situation because I knew I wanted to do it. And this was my dream at that point. So I was going to try and fight to get there. But I didn't have a lot of support. As in, by a lot of support, I mean financial support. I didn't know anyone in the United States who could, you know, help make this an easier transition. Maybe I could borrow money from or something like that. So what I did was I thought, you know, the best way for me is to get a part-time job when I got here that would cover all my expenses, my living expenses. And if I managed to be smart about it, I could save some and start paying it towards my loan. So what I did was I spoke to a lot of my fellow classmates, and I was like, what about, you know, part-times? Are people actually applying for it? How do we apply for it? Are there ways to do it? And everyone just kept saying how hard it is and that there are just so many students, so it's impossible to get it. And what I found was the people were actually kind of negating or not even trying to get it because they were already under the thought process that they were not going to get it. So, I mean, I guess I didn't have that option. So I was like, okay, I'm going to try whatever I can. So I reached out to a bunch of my professors and I was like, hey, I'm going to be really honest. This is a very hard situation for me. I don't have the money or the financial aid, you know, to support myself for my living situation. So I would love if you could give me a job on campus and I'm happy to work. And I sent it to about 10 professors. Obviously, not all of them responded. But one professor came back and he's like, I totally understand and empathize with you. And I'm going to find you a contact who can probably help. So that's kind of how the part-time jobs on campus started. I was connected to this one person who was in charge of all part-time jobs throughout the campus. So I got in touch with her and I had a part-time job the day I landed and started my master's. So that was really, really helpful. But I found that asking and kind of being very vulnerable about it, like tell them your story. Not everyone has an easy ride. Obviously, everyone has, you know, their own pains and everyone has a different. So everyone has a different story to tell. But if you do share, if you are vulnerable and you're honest enough, there are people out there who are willing to help because at some point they probably went through the same thing. And that has been my experience, at least with asking there.
I love what you're sharing. As anything in the US, networking rules, but you're also highlighting it's the human side that starts that networking connections.
Correct.
Asking isn't always easy. Yeah. There's fear of rejection, etc. But yeah, wow. Amazing that you reached out and amazing that the professor responded.
Yeah, I would say there's definitely some part of luck, definitely. But yeah, I was so relieved and so grateful that I got that opportunity because it has helped me so much ever since. And I try to be as open and honest as possible even now.
Definitely has stayed with you. And I'm sure your mother was also relieved when you graduated with 0 student loans.
Yes. She was like, I got my house back. I don't have to worry that I won't have a roof over my head now.
That was quite a leap of faith on her part as well. So amazing for her to do it, but also what an opportunity, but also responsibility and burden it must have been through those years.
Yeah, it's not easy when it is a lot of pressure because you know you don't have any other option. You know, you can't make a mistake along the way because if you do, then there are serious repercussions. But I did make mistakes along the way. And it's okay, though, because I was able to either ask for help or I was able to find a good set of friends who helped me through it. Or I was able to quickly rectify my mistake and find the right path again. So I would say there are definitely options. But yes, it's definitely pressure.
So you finished your master's. With no strings attached.
Yes.
And now your life as a data scientist starts. Was it what you expected? What was data science like day one?
That's a good question. So I actually started at a fintech startup. The whole company was 10 people. So I was the only, I would say, data analyst, data scientist, business intelligence engineer, applied scientists, so all the different titles that you can possibly put under it. working with an SDE on the data side of things. And it was primarily a data-driven company. So they were trying to grow that out. Now, for better or for worse, I think joining that company opened my eyes. It made me learn things at a much faster pace that I would have otherwise in a larger company, I think at least, because there was no one there to tell me what to do or tell me how to do it. I had to figure things out on my own. So I was given really ambiguous problems and I had to figure it out. Now, how I did and solved those problems were irrelevant, as long as they met the business need. And that's what I have found to be consistent actually over time in all the other companies I've joined as well. So I would say a startup is a lot of pressure. So I probably work 12, 14 hours a day. I didn't really have weekends. It was a lot and it definitely got to me at the end of it. Like I was like, I need a life. I want to go out when my friends are out. I want to date. I want to do things like that, which I didn't get the option to because I had absolutely no time. But then I found that I learned so much, I took it with me. And it was definitely really useful because it gave me or it empowered me with confidence. Because now when I went to the next company, they were like, do you know how to do this? Do you need any support? The fact that I was able to wear a couple of different hats and, you know, figure things out, I thought that gave me leverage there and helped me grow faster than what I would have if I hadn't joined a startup right at the beginning.
What was your reason for switching companies?
Honestly, just a work-life balance. More like just a little bit of a life balance. I didn't even want that much. I just wanted to have a little bit of a life.
A little bit of a life definitely helps.
Yes.
Love it. It is also the case, though, that your net worth during this period has a very steep curve up. So yeah. I'm hoping that negotiation was part of you moving companies this time around.
Yes, it was. So I knew, startups, at least this one was so young, they weren't paying me that much. So I started off very, very low. No stocks in the company as well, because they didn't believe in, you know, giving stocks at that point. So what? I think, yeah, I know. I was surprised myself because it was only 10 people. But that's kind of why I decided, I wanted more money. I was also living in New York City at that time. Yes, I did look for jobs that were going to pay me more, but I still hadn't gotten to the point where I knew how much I wanted in the next job. But I would say I got lucky because my next job was Aetna. And I got lucky there because they never asked me how much I earned. They never asked me what I wanted. And I think I lucked out with a good recruiter because all she said is, we want to offer you this much money. And I said, can I have $5,000 more? And she was like, yes, you can. I'm really glad you asked. I'm like, okay, this is great. And to be honest, at that point, it was maybe a 30% jump from my previous salary to the next.
I am so glad you asked as well. Hopefully, yeah. You've been asking ever since.
Yes, that has been my biggest learning. I have continued to ask ever since. And I feel like there's no harm asking. Like, you can ask. And, you know, what's the worst that could happen? They'll say no. And then, okay, that's fine. You know, I understand. So it's totally fine. But if you ask more times than not, I've realized they give you something. Mm-hmm. They will give you some additional amount. And you'd always be happy that you asked. So I would really, recommend and advise anyone to just ask. I know it's hard again, but just ask. It helps so much.
During this time, you also changed slightly from a traditional DS role in focusing more into AI ML. What's the difference as a data scientist?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I would say actually the data science role has kind of evolved over time. So the way I see it is there's a lot of overlap between data analysts and business intelligence and applied science. So that's kind of, all the four together was one role initially where it really depended on what you wanted to learn, where you wanted to go, and then you decide that way. But now it's split into four, which is actually a good thing because now you know if you're an applied scientist or a data scientist, this is possibly what I'm going to do next. And it makes things easier for, I guess, all of us in the longer term. Now, the reason I started shifting to AI ML, I did a couple of projects at Aetna, and I was also one of the first few people who joined the data team there. So I was given a lot of ownership as well as trust. And I'm so grateful for it because I had just a most amazing manager, Fabio, that I would always call out to. But oh my God, he was so good. And yeah, I'd say I've been lucky to have some really good managers and mentors along my way, which has helped as well. Now, the fact that he trusted me so much, I was able to solve a problem, again, that was a business need, in any way that I wanted. And I realized that you can solve it through like just pulling data and aggregations, which are important, and then doing a few statistical tests on it, right? That's one way, which is, I would say, more stats-based and more, it's not a lower tier. It's just like, it's a simpler place to get to rather than jumping all the way to a machine learning space. So the second step, once you get there, would be the machine learning side. And that's what I realized that I truly loved. Because I started using a lot of algorithms, understanding them, building them out from scratch, developing them. And I loved what they were capable of doing. I remember building one of my first, you know, automated solutions at Aetna, where I was using, it was as simple as like a random forest. A model where I was trying to predict out if a person was going to get diabetes or not. And it worked. It actually worked and it was giving me good results. And I was like, this is amazing. Like the potential of understanding these algorithms and learning them can just help so much. And that's kind of why I started moving more towards that side of things. And now I would say it's slowly come to deep learning. So a lot of, computer vision, ChatGPT, like things, like that's the new thing now. And that's kind of where all our roles are going to evolve to at some point of time. By all our roles, I mean for data science, that's kind of the path that's going to be headed towards. So I actually like that it's been a trajectory and like a learning journey, but that's why I've started moving towards the machine learning side.
I'm just so fascinated when you say building algorithms from scratch, etc. Are these skills that you had as a traditional data scientist, or did you have to learn on the job to build this out?
Yeah, it's definitely learning on the job. So the way I look at it is, let's say I'm given a problem. I try to find out what are the different ways that I can solve this problem. And there are several ways to solve one problem with data science. So now I look at, okay, I have maybe four options in front of me. Which one do I think would be the most useful? Secondly, which one do I think I would love to dive deeper into? And sometimes, actually most times, for me, if I will always try the easiest one first because it'll give me quick results and I know what my benchmark or my baseline is. But I will also try the hardest one because if I try that, I know I'm going to learn so much more and I'll probably do a course about it. I'll listen or read a couple of books about it, but it'll help me understand that problem so much better and kind of take that solution to the next step. And that's what's I found mostly worked for me so far.
You mentioned the role itself is moving more towards deep learning.
Right.
Someone who is interested in data science and want to poke around with what deep learning can do, what would be your recommendation on where to start?
Very good question. So a lot of my students that I teach also ask me this, but I would say there are five things that we have to know as a data science. First are the fundamental or the foundations. It's always better not to jump straight into deep learning. So probability, then understand statistics, then understand traditional machine learning algorithms, and then you can get to deep learning. Now, when you've understood the four parts before it really well, then deep learning becomes so much easier to understand because what's happening with each step is we're building on top of it and we're adding more complexity. And the only way you'll understand what you're doing there is if you know the parts before it. So foundation first, and even if you know you're a new data scientist, I would say definitely go through probability, statistics, and traditional machine learning. and then jump into the deep learning side of things because it'll make so much more sense to you.
Would you say you can do this through the online courses that you mentioned earlier, or?
Yes, for sure. Yeah, you can definitely do them through online courses. You can do them. So there are some AI ML like bootcamp certification courses as well. And that's kind of what I teach, like a postgraduate program. It depends on how much time you have, but it goes from like the very basics, fundamentals of statistics all the way up to, you know, building out your first neural network, which is the deep learning side of things, and trying to predict, do some image classification, like is that image a cat, is it a dog? And then obviously you get a lot more complicated there.
Is there any course that you would particularly recommend?
Yes, there's one course, actually one professor that I sometimes still quote because he is brilliant. So it's Andrew Ng, and he's done so many courses now. But one of the first courses I did was just on, I think, machine learning and data science. I'm not sure of the name, but I can share that later. But he goes through the basically the math of each algorithm that we're learning in traditional machine learning, and how it's useful, and how you can picture or visualize that algorithm working, which I found so fascinating. So even now, when someone asks me to explain, let's say, gradient descent, which is the algorithm which has stuck with me for about 5 or 6 years now, I explain it the same way he taught it on the course, which just makes so much sense.
There is the talk of town right now that with the advancement of AI, LLM, and all of these new technologies, that even engineering may become obsolete. Do you see any similar impact with data science?
I personally don't really believe that. So I do believe it won't. I don't think it'll become obsolete. I think it might become easier. It might make our lives easier by removing some redundant steps that we take in like productionalizing a model or deploying a model somewhere, or, you know, gathering data easily. I think that is what it can be made easier. Obviously, with like generative AI, like ChatGPT, we're going to get answers faster. We can get code written as well. But the thing is, we need the human side, right? Because at the end of the day, the business has a problem and we need a solution. And a lot of times the problem, there are some problems, yes, that can be, you can easily Google, you can do ChatGPT and you can get a solution for it. But the harder, challenging problems are the ones that don't have solutions outside. So you need a human for that. And I feel like as a computer engineer or a data scientist, we should leverage the tools that have been built, like ChatGPT, and actually there are so many out there, Llama, all the different LLM sort of models for generative AI specifically. We can reuse them to solve for our use cases. And that'll make things easier. I don't believe that we're going to be obsolete. I really hope not. I do feel like we still, you know, there is still the need for human intervention and interaction, because we have that sixth sense that generative AI doesn't, just yet, at least. Not yet.
Not yet.
Yes. Okay. Not yet.
I'd love to jump over to what your a day in the life of your role is. So if this is your working hour, what would you say? I don't want to say a typical work day, because every day might be so different, but maybe a typical week or month, like what consumes most of your time or brain power?
Okay, so I think most of my time or most of my brain power goes into understanding the business problem, the business need, and trying to figure out what we want from it, as well as where the data lies. So this is more like, a requirement gathering sort of situation. And this is only before a project, though. So I'm just taking it, let's say I have a new project. How much time would I be using for that? So obviously implementation is the biggest chunk. So let's say that the next is implementation. That takes a while depending on what's the problem. Also in terms of implementation, let's say I figured I need to use this new methodology that's out there. It means that I need to understand it. I need to learn this new methodology and apply it. So that does take the largest chunk.
So this is the actual building of the model, testing it, and executing. Yes. Okay.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. And I would say two parts. So, okay. So there's going to be another 25%, right? Which is actually gaining alignment, making sure whatever we're using is going to work and it's going to be useful to the business, getting stakeholders on board if it's something that's new. Most times, you know, you get the feedback that it's too complicated. So how do you make sure you don't get that feedback? So the way you communicate what you've just done, it has to be in layman terms. It has to show business impact. So I would say gaining alignment does take a bit of time. And this could be like presentations or a proof of concept or even, you know, even a demo, just so that you get everyone aligned. And the last piece is actually documentation. I feel like I find documentation super important. So I use it primarily because in case I forget something, I know exactly what I need to do, what I did to get there. And it's been super helpful. And I am generally very, very in depth with my documentation. I also wish, you know, this was more, I guess, industry-wide where documentation was required, because sometimes when you gain alignment and the project is, you know, in production, running very well, you think, okay, I've done it. This is great. But the thing is, things are going to break. You might leave the team. Someone else might leave the team. And documentation is the one saving grace at that point. So I do spend a little bit of time documenting as well. Yeah, I would say implementation is more like 10% of time is documenting, and implementation is more like 40% of my time.
You are speaking like a true Amazonian. Documentation. Super interesting.
I guess it finally rubbed off.
Thanks for sharing that. I want to jump off on what you said about gaining alignment, but in a completely different part of your life. So Gaining alignment with your partner when it comes to finances.
Interesting. Very good question. So I'll be honest, that's a hard conversation to have, especially at the beginning of a relationship. In my relationship with my husband, we struggled initially because, as we've spoken about, I have a very different, like a more saving mindset. You know, I don't want to simply buy things for the heck of it. I do like most of my spend will go in travel because that's where I believe that I'm making the most use of my money. But again, that's personal preference. And he was on the opposite. For him, money doesn't mean anything. It'll come, it'll go. If you have it, spend it. Like, why not? So, and I'm always saving for a rainy day. And he's like, when the rainy day comes, we'll figure it out. So very different mindsets. So initially it was really hard because we were just doing things, you know, by ourselves. I spent for what I wanted. He spent for what he wanted.
Something similar in relationship to money with your mother as your husband?
Yes. I've noticed that slowly over time as well.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So we actually after all the fights and, you know, where the awkward money conversation, we realized it's time for us to sit down and talk about it. And then I think as we were dating, we were living together and we figured out that how we were. So that definitely helped. And we had a very good conversation. I told him what I thought was important. He told me what he thought was important. And we tried to hit a middle ground. And I honestly think for everyone, it's going to be different. It's whatever works for y'all. So right now, I can talk to my experience, but with my partner and I, we've come to a middle ground where we've decided if there's something like really extravagant that he wants to splurge on, as he's very big into business class tickets when we travel. And I'm like, I don't on that. So he's like, but I really like it. So we've come to a conclusion that, okay, he should buy the tickets with his money and it's totally fine. And I will sit in economy and I'm actually okay with that because I'd rather save that money for, I don't know, doing a few more extra days of traveling or going to a different place. So again, it's just so much perspective. And I feel like, maybe initially it was, you know, that awkward, weird conversation, but with time we've seen that it's kind of funny how everyone thinks so differently. And we've had this conversation with a lot of our friends, a lot of the couples, And every single one of them have a different setup with their finances. There are some that have no joint account and they just want to use Splitwise for everything, but that works for them. There are some where they have some joint and some, on Splitwise, but that works for them. And some people who just have one account for everything and it irrespective of what you buy. But I would say it's better to have that conversation sooner rather than later, because sometimes it can be so different from what you are and what you believe in that it might not work. So it's good to understand, you know, where you are, as yourself, like, where are you with money? What is your relationship with money? And then figure out what your partner's relationship with money is and find that middle ground. And it's going to be a couple of fights, but I think eventually we'll get there.
I feel that is so important. We have seen study after study that shows money issues, as in the form of different money values, different money spending habits, is one of the top three reasons couples get divorced.
Yeah.
So making sure that you have alignment early on and continuously having that discussion, even though it is so awkward.
Yeah.
It's not in our culture to talk about money.
It's not. I know.
It doesn't get easier when you get married. I think it's super important. Did you, at any point in the discussion, how were you able to align on a common direction? I love the fact that you have agreed on yours and mine in terms of different spending and acknowledging it and respecting it, which I think is super healthy, but the direction should still be aligned.
Correct. And so by direction, can you give me an instance?
Target or a goal that you're both...
Right.
Or a future that you're building towards. That might be a better way to put it.
Yeah, and that is true. So to be honest with the direction, we haven't been thinking too far out. I mean, by we, I have been thinking pretty far out and my husband has been thinking far out. So we've decided, since he's not definitely not the saver, and we've already realized that, I definitely think of, so I try to do that kind of savings, like the saving for a rainy day, the fun, saving for if his mom or my mom, you know, need the money, if they're sick, if we need, you know, to pay for anything, send money to India. Like those are things that we've discussed and I save money towards a fund. Now, when it comes to spending things, I'm just generally not a big spender. I mean, travel's the only thing, but sometimes I would say, since he likes the business class, I would do one business class a year just to go with him. So he's okay with that. In terms of the general direction, my husband wants to retire when he's 40. So that's his goal. But I love working, so I'm not ready to retire anytime soon. So we've decided that, you know, we kind of have to put whatever makes us happy before even the direction that we're trying to head in. Because at the end of the day, yes, we have to always have, I mean, for me, we have to have a savings, which is about 3 to 6 months of our, you know, expenditure. And then we should be okay because by then we can figure out if something goes wrong. But other than that, now the money that comes in, which is not going into this rainy day fund, can be used for whatever we think or we deem important. And the thing is, luckily, we're both working now, so he can decide where his goes versus I can decide where mine goes. But then we do have this one common fund where the bucket has to reach a particular level just so that we have money for travel that we're going to do together. So I think at this point, we're kind of leaving it a little bit flexible because let's say when we have kids, it's going to be a whole different ballgame, right? There's going to be that much more expenses. How do we deal with that? But as long as we have, I think, enough money for a house for us to live and plus a rainy day fund, we're thinking that's good enough for now. Because the thing is, if we over-engineer this direction too much, it just gets so complicated because things change so quickly. And in all honesty, even I'm not sure what that right answer is or if there's even a right answer for it. So I guess taking it 1 or 2 years at a go makes the most sense to us at this point.
That makes a lot of sense. Out of curiosity, though, It sounds like your husband is aiming for FIRE at 40, which is hoorah to him. It also sounds he is a bit of a spender.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that where is the delta of the investment coming from where he's going to be able to afford FIRE at 40? Is that also like taken into account and he's doing it on his own?
No, so we both have a fund. So I might be oversharing, but Allied Bank has this amazing bucket high yield savings account, which you can also invest in. So you basically put in a certain amount and a percentage of it goes into each of the different buckets you set up for yourself. So we have this set up where a percentage of our salaries goes into this, where it goes into the different buckets that we both aligned with. So there's a travel bucket, there's a rainy day fund bucket where I've given a larger percentage than he does. And then there's this business class bucket, which is just his. And then we have like for our dogs, for the house in case of renovation. So we've kind of like bucketed out expenses that way. And we've started an additional bucket, which is basically him retiring at 40. And trying to see if, you know, we can actually live with a one person salary at that point. So we're trying to see how that works. But this bucketing policy, I've been amazed at how amazing that is. I've been thrilled ever since we've set that up.
Ally's sub account feature is definitely a really cool part.
Yeah.
And this is on top of all of the 401ks and the IRAs. Okay.
Exactly.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It was super interesting. Thank you for oversharing.
Of course.
I appreciate it. It's been fun. Thanks for coming on, Tanvi.
Of course. No, Minky, this was so much fun too. So if you have, you know, any other questions or anything else, feel free to ask me. I think this is such an important thing that you're doing. I have so much respect for you for doing this because it's really good to have someone out there that can provide answers. And I would say I wish I had someone out there. I wish I came across this when I was much younger, right? Because it's going to give you so much additional information that you probably never thought of. So kudos to you for even having this. I think it's so good. And women empowerment is definitely needed.
Love it. Please send Amazonians who are early in their financial journey to Winnie. I do think you definitely would have earned quite a few new fans in ETS, ML, deep learning side. Where can people find you to find your course?
Right. So right now I am teaching at BrainStation. So I teach a machine learning and AI course with them. I want to try broadening that a little bit. So I think they can find me there or they can just reach out to me on LinkedIn and I'm happy to provide them, you know, the course to where I'm teaching next because I do work across a number of different companies.
Sounds great. We'll connect on LinkedIn for new updates.
Yes, that sounds great.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, Minky. Have a good one. Bye.